Hi, I'm Cindy Simmons, and this is Inside Stories from the MPA, the podcast of Manchester Publicity Association. It's where you'll hear the latest insights and experience from other industry leaders in this great city. You'll also find out about the MPA's upcoming news and events. In this episode, you're going to hear an interview with Sasha Lord to coincide with the launch of his book, Tales from the Dance Floor. Manchester's music history is the stuff of legends, and Sasha's been a huge part of this, as we all know. From the Hacienda to the Warehouse Project to Park Life, he's thrown some of the biggest parties in this city. Sasha was interviewed at an exclusive MPA event for members by Lisa Morton, who's a board member for the MPA and also is founder of Roland Ransfield and co-founder of Purposeful Podcasts, who make this podcast. We met at WP's Manchester campus in Spinningfields recently. That interview is coming up very, very soon. But first, it's time for What's Up and What's On from the MPA. So what's going on in the industry at the moment? So AI, we had a fantastic speaker, as most of you know, back in March around the subject of AI. And since then, we've seen tons of events rolling out. And one of my fellow board members said they had three to choose from this week to go to. So obviously, it's still a very, very hot subject, a hot topic. So we'll be doing more around that in terms of how it's applied to industry and some quite interesting outtakes of how people are using it and what they should do, etc. So watch out for that from us. DE&I, obviously huge again for the industry, and the MPA is very much about looking at where we can help industry look at what we should be doing for the next generation of talent coming through, particularly young people from less advantaged backgrounds. So that's a big hot topic with us for the moment and the industry as a whole. So look out for more on that. And obviously things like our awards. I mean, our awards are now closing for entries on the 17th of May. It's great to see entries coming in. And as we all know, it's a big celebration of Manchester and its creative industries. And it's only Manchester, and that's what we're very, very proud about. So please, if you haven't started to think about entering, do think about entering. And there's a showcase is in October, which I'll mention next time we record. But it's really something to be a part of because it's a true reflection of our great industry in Manchester. So time for what's on now. Here are some key events we've got coming up in the next few weeks. One thing I wanted to kick off with and mention, we are about to undertake at the end of this month a big survey around DE&I. We led the way back in 2019 by doing a very detailed survey looking at this subject. And Alex, who's heading up DE&I for us on the board, has taken that on board and is looking at how we can move that survey forward and bring it into sort of now time. So that's been worked on currently. So that's a big initiative. So look out for that in your inboxes coming through the end of this month. And please, please do participate, because only by getting feedback from members, non-members and other associates will we actually be able to help drive this agenda forwards. On that very subject and the subject of talent, it kind of works together. So on the 5th of June, we're partnering with the Ideas Foundation, which we have for many years. The Ideas Foundation is very much about looking at how industry can mentor the next generation of talent coming through, again, from particularly diverse backgrounds. So that's a big initiative that we've always supported. But we're doing a panel discussion on the subject on the 5th of June and launching the survey results. So that's really one worth putting in your diary. So that's 5th of June at WPP campus, which is great. There is an invite-only event coming around. That's on the 23rd of May. That will be aimed at inviting creatives in Greater Manchester to come to this, because when I say a leading creative will be doing a keynote, it's a leading creative doing a keynote. So if you get an invitation bobbing into your inbox from myself or the partners who are sponsoring this, we are the allies, then look out for that invitation. It's going to be strictly limited numbers, so do watch out for that and hope you're one of the lucky ones. So that's what's happening at the moment. Time now to hear from Lisa Morton and Sasha Lord from their conversation at WPP's Manchester campus. Here are some edited highlights.
And as you say, hey, it feels like I've just died with these curtains moving like that there.
We were on the corner and Sasha said, "Is anyone up there?" Yeah, I think it's imposter syndrome. We didn't think anyone would turn up. So I'm sure Sasha doesn't need much of an introduction. obviously co-founder of Warehouse Project, Part Life, Andy Burnham's nighttime economy advisor, and also chair of Withenshaw Football Club. And I don't know where you fit it all in, to be honest. But you've also just recently launched Tales from the Dance Floor, and we've got some news hot off the press.
Yeah, so talk about imposter syndrome that I talk about in the book. I had a call an hour ago. It's actually a Sunday Times bestseller. And honestly, I'm like, I got a U in English Lit. And I just wish Mr. Bowl, my English teacher, was still alive. But yeah, no, made
amazing.
Up. It gets announced tomorrow, so
yeah,
unbelievable.
Amazing.
I actually beat RuPaul's Diaries, which, and annoyingly, so my wife's told me off of this. I came second, which if I was like fifth or sixth, I'd be fine with that. But second, I've been beaten by a dead dog called Max.
Not for the first time.
No. What do you mean?
So what did it feel like when you first got the book in your hands?
It was so weird because obviously Luke Bainbridge is my co-author. I've been working on this thing for about 14 months. But when the box arrived and you open it up and you're there, you're holding your piece of work, you can't bottle it. It's a very nice feeling.
And it's that smell, isn't it, of a new book as well? So when it's your own as well.
I don't go around smelling books.
So I do.
No. <Weird. laughs>
And so what was the process? You wrote it with Luke, who's a well-known journalist. Why did you choose him and what was the process like?
So I chose, firstly, why did I choose Luke? I chose Luke because he's known me throughout my whole career. I think he's known me for 26 of the 30 years. So when I was sat there and we're talking about Angela Matthews, who was the assistant manager at Hacienda, I didn't have to explain to him who that was. He knew everybody. So it was a much easier process. But actually, it was very, very therapeutic. And one thing I've done over the years is I've been a hoarder. So all my old flyers from Hacienda, from Sankey's, the first ones, Warehouse Project, the first ticket to Sankey's, I've kept them all. And Luke said, let's start talking about these things. And so many stories came out of there. So it was nice to go through it. And a few don't actually appear in the book.
Yeah, and if you've not read the book already, it's absolutely fantastic. I've kind of almost read it twice now. And what's great about it is the fact that even though you wrote it together, it is so you. No, you know what I mean? Some of the sense of humour and some of your expletives that are very you, I think, all the way through the book. You get those in.
That was the worst thing. So we had the book launch on Thursday night and my mum was in the room, my wife was in the room, Andy Burnham's full team were in the room, and I kept wanting to swear and I couldn't. So when it got to Friday for part two, I couldn't help it. Every second word was the F word.
Yeah, it was a great night. And we held it in a place that's never been seen in Manchester for ages. So it's very kind of authentic.
So I didn't want to have a book launch in an existing place. Because one thing I've always tried to do is bring to life venues like Bonington's Brewery, when it's closed, brought that to life with Warehouse Project. Then the Air Raid Shelter on Store Street, there was also a car park, then Mayfield Depot. It was always bringing life to these buildings. And I found a space, it was your friend actually that said 4 or 5 months ago, come look at this space that I bought. And it was an old cinema that's not been used since the 70s. And I just thought, this is ideal. And I'm convinced someone will snap that up. It's going to be a live music venue, convinced of it. But it was a good party, wasn't it?
It was amazing, yeah. But I forgot there was no plumbing, so we were all out the back at the Portaloos, which made it feel very authentic, didn't it?
I never have posh toilets at my events.
But when you say it's one of my friends...
Shall I give you an industry tip? And you can carry this with you for the rest of your lives. Don't do this at my event because it's a real bane in the lives for festival organisers. But when you go to a festival, take a 50p piece with you. And when you've been searched, run to a toilet, a Portaloos that's hidden away. It's probably not going to get used that much. And you'll notice on the handle there's a little notchet. You can lock that Portaloos from the outside with your 50p piece. And then that's your own private Portaloos for the rest of the festival. It was worth buying the book for that.
It made me laugh. Was it when you did, the Warehouse Project and some kids came on the coach from somewhere, Middlesbrough?
No, it wasn't Warehouse
Where
Project.
Where was it?
That was that sowed the seed for Warehouse Project. That was Tribal Gathering in 2003. Oh. I managed to get the licence for the first warehouse rave since John Major stopped them all. And it was on Pollard Street, which is now Shiny Flats. And this poor kid, coaches came in from all over the country. And I think you're right, this coach was from Newcastle. And in the first 2 hours, this guy had gone to the toilet and his friends thought it'd be hilarious, which it wasn't, to knock the portillo over. And the guy came out covered head to toe in piss and shit. And he had to sit on the coach till 6 a.m. by himself. We tried our best to clean him down. But, I mean, you know, I'm asking...
Not too many friends.
No, he just sat on the back of that. I felt so sorry for him.
So the book is A Love Letter to Manchester. So can you just give our audience a sense of what they can expect in the book?
I think it shows how far Manchester's come. So the opening scene, I'm dragged into the back of a 7 Series BMW by gangsters who were running Manchester at that point, certainly in the nighttime economy. And they were running the doors, they were running, once you had the doors, they were running what was happening inside the venues. And to where it is now, you know, the Sunday Times called us the UK's capital of nightlife last year, which I'm not taking any claim on at all, just to my close friends. But, you know, we are, as a city region, we're absolutely bouncing. And we've come out of the traps, out of COVID, quicker than any other city region. I'm so proud of our nightlife where we are now. But it shows where it was the Wild West, it was Gunchester, and now the likes of London, Birmingham, everyone, Liverpool, everyone's looking at what's going on in Manchester.
I mean, one of the chapters in that is dodging bullets and rain. Is that right? Yeah. And that was that on...
It was a T-shirt made by the Donnellys, yeah. Gilgoy.
But it was, I mean, do you want to take us back to kind of 1990s Manchester? Because a lot of people in this room won't have even been born at that point. But it was as bad as you're pointing out.
Yeah, so I think two incidents that are in the book, and my mum was very surprised when she read them for the first time a couple of weeks ago, was the first instance I was shot at. So Home Nightclub, which is on Ducie Street, just behind Dakota Hotel, it's now offices, Ducie House, still owned by Tom Bloxham. And all the gangs were fighting each other to try and get the door to get control. And I was doing the guest list, and I remember it so vividly. I was holding a lime green Perspex clipboard, doing the guest list on a Saturday, and this car came around the corner, slow motion, and sprayed bullets across the whole of the front door. These massive six foot two guys all ran inside, pulled the shutters down, just left me there with the clipboard. And my mum's like, why didn't you tell me about this? It's like, well, how was work last night, Sasha? Oh, yeah, it was great. Anything exciting? Yeah, I was shot at. I mean, that, you know, so that's one thing. And then when I opened Sankey's, the old door firm from Salford wanted the door then. And I said, the police had told me there's no way they could have the door. And at the back of Sankey's in the car park, there was a substation. So they climbed over the fence the night before, and the fire officer phoned me up in the early hours to say the club's on fire. They'd climbed over, entwined a bed mattress around the generator, poured petrol all over it and set it alight. It blew up. But what they didn't realise was because Sankey's was in an original mill, we had our own generator. So actually that weekend, we were raving, and the rest of Ancoats was in pitch black. Seriously.
And when you would reopen Sankey's, was it when you were at home, with Tom Bloxham, you had issues there, didn't you, with the door, that you were getting money taken off of you at the door by the guys that ran it, the gang?
It was common practice in those days. And it was only student nights, so I was only charging, I think it was £2.50 before 11, £3 after, and they taxed me 50p a person. Mm-hmm. But that was the norm. Mm-hmm.
And so kind of going back to early years, because obviously, you know, it's well documented that you went to Manchester Grammar School. In actual fact, going back to my friend who gave you the space for the launch last week, you had like a lifelong kind of grudge against him, didn't you?
I hate him. So I was in the second year at school, so I would be 12, and I was running down the corridor, and he gave me a Saturday morning detention for running down a corridor. How tight's that?
But you nailed him on the deal, didn't you, to get the rent for
it? Yeah. Yes.
Back in the end. But it's documented that when you were at school, you didn't feel that you quite fitted in, did you, with, not fitted in, but in terms of your kind of peers seemed to have really clear ideas on what they wanted to do in the future.
They were, and that wasn't Manchester Grammar's fault. It's a fantastic school. I'd never knock it. But all all the pupils in my class knew they wanted to go to Oxford or Cambridge or St. Andrews or, you know, really good universities. I didn't have a clue what I wanted to do. I was lucky that it coincided with the explosion of Madchester. So Stone Roses, Happy Mondays, New Order, James, Factory Records. And I became obsessed with that. So they all went off to university to become doctors, lawyers, accountants. My first job was in a clothes shop in Altrincham, £20 a day. It was the first flannels, actually. Goose Green, correct. And that's where I worked. And then 4th of July 1994, I put my first event on at the Hacienda.
But you were flogging leather jackets, knock-off leather jackets at the same time.
Well, they weren't knock-off. I thought they were stealing
them.
It says
knock-off in that book. I read it twice.
No, they weren't knock-off. So I'd work in the clothes shop Monday to Saturday. Yeah. I think from memory, I'd get a day off during the week. I can't remember. 20 quid a day. But then I found a place in Wetherby near Leeds that sold leather jackets for Next. And literally, if there was the tiniest thing wrong with them, like a button had fallen off, they'd sell them for 20% what they should be. So I'd buy these jackets, get my mum to sew the buttons on or work on the zip, and then sell them in a market in Liverpool on a Sunday. And that was kind of my first mini business venture.
Mm. And you said in the book that Noel Gallagher remembers the first time he heard the song Sally Cinnamon and knew that that was his light bulb moment, because he could write songs like that. So what was yours?
Walking into the Hacienda summer in 1989. I'll never forget it. It was such, and it sounds a bit cliche, a bit cheesy, but it didn't matter who you were. It didn't matter what background you were from. It didn't matter what job you had. It didn't matter whether you had a job. It didn't matter whether you were still at university or college or in fact school. I was 17, I shouldn't have been in there. Everyone was there for one reason, that was the love of the music. Mm-hmm. And it was probably only 6 months after that it's myself and my friend Pete Armistead that went in there, who I think he went on to become a vicar. We lost contact. But I think it was 6 months later we realised we were the only people not on ecstasy inside the venue that time. But it blew me away, because I'd been going to all those clubs that I call them the carpeted chrome clubs, like 21 Piccadilly or Discotheque Le Royale, where... why are you laughing at that?
Because we remember.
So I could probably, half 12, there'd be 20 minutes of ABBA. Yeah. And you knew exactly what tracks are going to play, and then they'd announce on the microphone, oh, it's happy birthday, it's Sharon's birthday. But this is the first time I'd seen the customer worshipping the DJ that was on a raised platform like that. And, yeah, it was a guy called Mike Pickering, who incidentally also appears in the book, because first year of Warehouse Project, Mike Pickering then was head of A&R for Sony Records, and he phoned me up and said, look, I've got this artist, Scottish guy, any chance you can put him on New Year's Eve? And I'm like, well, it's in 8 weeks, Mike. I can't really do it. It's already programmed and we've already sold out as well. It's like, oh, please, please, I need this favour. I need to try and impress him. So we put this guy on, this young kid. And I was a kid at the time as well. Anyway, he went on at 9 o'clock. We didn't tell him the club actually didn't open until 9:30. So for the first 30 minutes, he was playing to no one. I paid him £250. He gave me train tickets after his set. He only did an hour. He came down first class. I never agreed to give him first class, so I gave him money for standard. It makes me sound really tight, but he's had the last laugh, because that guy was called Calvin Harris, and he now gets paid £1.2 million for every set he does.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah.
So also, when we were at the book launch, you were sitting next to your mum, and the book is dedicated to your mum, and said, I've still not got a proper job, but it's turned out okay. Your mum looked so proud, and your mum's been a massive force in your life, hasn't she?
No, that's Botox. She can't express anything. Her face is frozen. So that's just a constant grin that she has.
You're so tight about your mum.
She's not here, is she? She's not going to know.
But you nearly sacked your mum once, didn't you?
I did sack her.
So tell us that story. Yeah.
So I'm not on Facebook. I am on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, but not Facebook. And it was, I think, the second year at Parklife, someone came running up to me. My mum was in the cash office, working in the cash office. Like, I can't believe what your mum's put on Facebook. I'm like, what? And he showed me. And when the money comes in, it would have been 2011, it was all cash. There was no credit card facilities. So the money would come in, it would get counted, then someone would recount it, put the little paper slip on it. Then it went into a big plastic tub for G4S to take off site. My mum decided to take her trainers off, put her feet in the cash like that, posted a picture saying, warming my feet in Sasha's cash. That's why I sacked her. What a ridiculous thing to do.
Did she get your point?
Did what?
Did she get your point? Did she understand?
I don't. She thought she doesn't understand. Once, so occasionally I get trolls, which might surprise people. She answers them. I'm like, you can't do that. Because, but they're being horrible to you. Just leave them, honestly. They don't bother me.
But, I mean, the whole cash thing, like, you know, back in the day, there was only cash, wasn't there? So, I mean, that was a real issue from a kind of safety point of view for you, wasn't it?
Well, it was, because it's in those days, that is a gangster's dream. Mm-hmm. Because, obviously, completely untraceable. The numbers aren't sequential or anything like that. So, yeah, to get that cash would be a huge win. And we did actually have... It's in the book, an armed robbery. Easter 2013, £130,000. And they came in with machetes and took it all.
I mean, one time, didn't you have about 200 grand strapped to your back all weekend as well?
110 grand. So what? No, that was the warehouse party I was talking about then. It finished at 6 in the morning. And when I tell you, Ancoats back then, taxis wouldn't drop people off at Sankey's. There were needles on the floor. There was no street lighting. So to see it now, for me personally, is so, so impressive. It really is. If you'd said to me you're going to have a Michelin-star restaurant behind Sankey's in 2006, I would have thought you'd nick the confiscation box. impossible. But it's happened. And, yeah, we finished at 6 in the morning. And when I had Sankey's, I was used to security just finishing 15 minutes late to make sure everyone had left. But actually, to get rid of 12,000 people, I didn't realise would take up to an hour. So, quarter past six, security had gone home. And we were left, it wasn't my money, we had to pay supplies and stuff, but we were left with 110 grand in cash on site. So, me and Elisa, bearing in mind that was a Saturday, the banks didn't open until Tuesday. We put 55k each in our rucksacks, closed the curtains for 3 days. I sat on the loo in my rucksack, I went to bed in my rucksack. I watched telly in my rucksack, I had a shower in my rucksack, that rucksack, she did the cooking in a rucksack, it did not leave our backs. So relieved to walk into HSBC on that Tuesday morning. Oh.
And you just couldn't let people know where you live, could you, back in the day? That was, no. Which is why you've been so private ever since.
Yes.
So tell us about your relationship with your dad, because I knew that you'd struggled with your dad, and when I read it made me really, really upset. And it's testament to you that you've dealt with that and that you've gone on to prove him wrong. So are you happy to share that? Because it's not something you often talk about.
No, I felt like I had to get it out. He was a shit, actually. So there's no nice way of saying that. He was a womanizer. He was a gambler. He was an alcoholic. If you write a list of the 10 worst things to do, he ticked all the boxes. And I think that is what just spurred me on. There have been so many times when I've had to make a decision and I've not known the right answer. And I've actually thought to myself, well, what would my dad do? And then whatever I thought he'd do, I've done the opposite. Mm. And that's how I've worked it out. But yeah, he wasn't a nice person at all. He died when he was 52, actually.
Mm. But your granddad...
So at least he can't read the book.
No, he can't.
Yeah.
But tell us the story about your granddad, because, I mean, you said in the early in the book that you kind of perfected the Manchester art of blagging, which has obviously stood you in good stead. But tell that story about your granddad, who's brilliant.
Complete fluke. So he was into textiles, and he got this massive order from Sweden for black fabric. He didn't have the money to pay for it, so he literally remortgaged his house, went to the banks, borrowed money off friends, family, scraped the cash together to purchase this black fabric. The biggest order of his life. 3 days before he's due to be shipped out, they cancelled the order. And literally, he was going to lose the shirt off his back, everything. Fortunately for him, not fortunately for us. At the same time, 48 hours later, World War II started. And the government wanted to buy as much black fabric as possible for the blackouts. So when the German bombers would come over, especially places like Salford and stuff, to black out the lights, they put the black fabric up at the windows, and overnight, complete fluke.
Unbelievable, that story. I just want to go back to the first time you went to the Hacienda, because this is important, we discussed this. What were you wearing?
So, why is that funny? I was wearing, I'll never forget it, I was wearing jeans. Prince had been in Manchester, and Prince had been in Manchester to play a concert, and he went to this place called Lom, which is a clothes shop. It sold very, very, very high-end clothing, like Jean-Paul Gaultier and Yohji Yamamoto and Comme des Garçons. And there was a mate called Armand Bassey that Prince, there was a photo of him wearing this Armand Bassey top on stage that he'd bought that night. So I didn't have a pot to piss in, but I wanted to go into the shop, and I went in there and I saw this jumper. Anyway, my dad bought me that jumper, and it was only a few weeks later I found out it was a knockoff from a pub in Liverpool. But anyway, bought me this jumper, and it was a thick woolen polo neck. It was black, cream down the front with three black stars. Bearing in mind, the Hacienda was one of the hottest clubs you could possibly walk into. But I went in there with a full-on pullover rather than, and yet someone commented on it, I'll never forget it, made my night.
And it always, when we interviewed Andy Burnham for the podcast We Built This City, he said that he used to go to the Hacienda with all his mates from Leeway, doesn't he? I think lives in Lee. And he always had the wrong outfit on, so he always got pulled out in the queue, and he spent more time in the Britain's Protection over the years because he could never get in the Hacienda. So what happened then? So talk us through the start of Part Life, because that started out as Mad For It.
So there was a festival called Mad For It, which five students, Southern students, put on. It was a play on Mad For It, like a Manchester saying, not very funny. And it was quite a good idea, but they didn't quite tick all the boxes. And on the second year, they phoned me up with 3 days to go. I didn't even know them. I knew of them, but I'd never met them. They said, can we borrow £100,000? Like, well, A, I didn't have £100,000, but B, why would I possibly lend you that? Well, we want to put this festival on. If we don't, it's not going to happen. You can sit behind the bar and take the first £100,000. Like, guys, listen, it's not going to happen. The event actually did go ahead, but they ran up a load of debts and ran off. Two of them are still shareholders of Part Life. Three ran off. Fair play to those two guys, Ben and Jax. They paid their pro rata amount of debt. But we thought at the time, like when I was at school, Halloween was a big American thing, and it's only just started to come into the UK. And at that time of Part Life, the word prom was starting to appear, an end-of-year prom, which obviously is an American thing. So we said, why don't we have an end-of-year student party in Fallowfield, the heart of student lands at Platt Fields? And we did. It started off one day, 20,000 people. Not in our wildest dreams did we think it'd become 2 days, 80,000 people. It's now the biggest metropolitan festival in the UK, which I'm really proud about, to have it in Manchester. But yeah, that's how Part Life started.
And what are some of the standout, kind of, there's plenty of funny stories in there about Part Life. So have you got anything that you can share?
The one that gave me the most fear, actually, was it was hilarious once we'd realised what had happened, but the police, I didn't know this. And again, another tip, if you go to a festival, it's just one key for all the buggies. So if you've got a key, you can literally take any buggy at all, that's it. And GMP had left event control, which is like the heart of the festival where I sit. And they'd gone to the North Gate to take the drugs confiscations. Now, 80,000 people going through North Gate, there was enough to fill a bin bag, okay? And I don't know why they did this, but they parked the buggy up. They'd put it in the back, parked the buggy up, and then came in to tell one of their colleagues something, went back out, the buggy gone. So all we knew was there was a buggy driving around Part Life with a black bin bag full of drugs. And we actually, they found it. The cleaners had taken it, not knowing what was in the bag. Right. They were just going around minding their own business. But these two guys were driving around with, must have been hundreds of thousands of pounds worth of drugs in the back of it.
And you told me before, there's a whole kind of like ecosystem that sets itself up around Part Life. So obviously there's like the Ring of Steel type thing, but some people have got businesses now in the area, haven't they, based on the back of Part Life?
They have. So a lot of residents, and I understand completely why, a lot of residents get quite upset about Part Life. We're winning them over slowly over the years. But it always fascinates me when I'm leaving at the end of the night, they've got trestle tables at the bottom of the drives and they're selling samosas or bottled water. Some of them are doing Airbnb in the gardens.
Yeah.
£800 for the weekend. It's a tent, but you do get a cooked breakfast and to use the toilet facilities. It's great. It's brilliant.
But it's a kind of Manchester spirit, that, isn't it? Yeah, they're making the most of it. What about, so we had to cancel Part Life, didn't you, when it was the 2020. And then you put it back to later in the year, didn't you, in 2021. So
it's always in June, but yeah, that year we had to put it back to September. Mm.
So tell us about that, because it clashed with Ronaldo's second homecoming, didn't it?
Yeah, so I would have liked to have been there. Yeah. But quite a few of the team came down. So we had Darren Fletcher was there. This is something I'll never be able to work out. So Paul Pogba played the full 90 minutes. I think it was 94 minutes. 20 minutes after the final whistle, he was in Part Life. He can't have gone to the dressing room. He's a big fan of D-Block Europe and Burner Boy. So I literally think he ran into the vehicle waiting for him and changed in the vehicle, because he was on site at Part Life 20 minutes after. Unbelievable. 10 minutes after that, he was on stage with Burner Boy dancing, which was incredible. But Darren Fletcher was there. Pogba left within good time. The thing that really grates me is, now, for counter-terrorism reasons, at 9:30, this isn't a bit that grates me, this is good. For counter-terrorism reasons, we put concrete blocks around all the roads surrounding Part Life, because when people are leaving, 80,000 people, a vehicle is classed as a weapon. And we saw this in the south of France, didn't we, in Saint-Tropez? So that's the reason why we do it. So if you're not out before those blocks come down, you're stuck, you're in. Doesn't matter. I can't get, no one can get out. And I remember at 12:30 being at the barrier ready to leave, and I looked at the car next to me, and it was Marcus Rashford and Jesse Lingard. And I was so annoyed. I was thinking, there is no way Alex Ferguson would allow footballers out on a Sunday night till 12:30. And I knew Jesse Lingard had been drinking as well. But 2 days later, I was sat at home watching them in the Champions League play Young Boys. And in the final 5 minutes, Jesse Lingard did the most ridiculous pass back. The other team got it scored. And I feel partly to blame that United got kicked out of the Champions League.
I love that story. I remember that happened at the time. I couldn't believe it because it went viral. Pogba was just straight. It was like, you say, half an hour, it went everywhere, didn't it?
Yeah.
Just touching on Warehouse Project and Boddington's. I mean, I think it's well documented that Factory Records was called Factory in kind of a nod to the fact that we were kind of post-industrial city.
Yeah.
And it was about factory clothes. That's where that came from. But you wanted.
So they did factory opening.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. So, and for you then, the whole Boddington's piece was a really good news story for Manchester, wasn't it? So,
well, they actually closed that place down 3 months before we opened it. So, and it was a sad story. It was all over the news. Generations who'd worked in there, sons, dads, granddads, you know, all their lives had been working in Boddington's, the cream of Manchester. Mm. And they left, so we thought, let's bring it back to life again. What we didn't know, and no one clocked it stupidly, it was fully licensed. So police, environmental health, fire thought, yeah, this is great, let's crack on. A real Manchester spirit. It was right next door to Strange Ways Prison. So the very first night, 6th of October, I had Public Enemy playing. And my phone started to ring with held number. I never answer with held number because it's normally a blagger for a guest list. But after about the 7th or 8th time, it was just before midnight, I answered it. I was like, hello. It's like, is that Sasha Lord? Like, yeah, who's that? I'm the governor of Strange Ways Prison. What time do you close tonight? So I said, 1 o'clock, it's a gig. He said, oh, that's okay then. I said, but we're open again tomorrow. What do you mean you're open again tomorrow? I said, well, we're open every Friday and Saturday now for the next 12 weeks, 4 or 5 o'clock closing. It was a nightmare. So we were getting letters on Strange Ways Prison letterhead on like a Tuesday or a Wednesday morning saying, oh, I've been on your website, amazing set from Annie Mac last Saturday. Can you send me a tape? The bass was leaking from our roof straight into Strange Ways Prison. And the governor is on record as saying the Warehouse Project created the biggest drug spike in Strange Ways Prison on record.
Really?
Yeah.
What an accolade.
Almost as good as a Sunday Times bestseller. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, you've done so much to support hospitality and the nighttime industry. And COVID was a massive issue, wasn't it, at the time?
Bit of a one. Yeah.
Bit of a one. But, you know, hospitality was decimated, wasn't it? So just talk us through, you know, how that spoke to you and why you decided to kind of stand up for that particular sector.
I think for the first week, we were all in shock. And then probably because I'm a bit of a... I put my head above the parapet. So I thought, I was getting so many messages from people who's, they could see their lives were being ruined, houses are going to be repossessed, marriages fall into bits. And I thought, I need to do something here. I just needed to step up. Mm-hmm. And I had the full backing of Andy Burnham right the way through it. And in fact, it's in the craze, Nihal from BBC Five Live said that me and Andy were like the Cray twins on the government. I really like that. I hope I was not the mad one.
Well, you got involved and you got rid of the Scotch egg rule, didn't you?
I did. Took Matt Hancock to the High Court.
Yeah.
Do you remember him? What a dig. I'm a celebrity. TikTok influencer, Matt Hancock. So I took him to court for two reasons. Firstly, with Park Life, one of the hardest things I have to do is to get 80,000 people out at 11 o'clock. The answer is you can't. So people often give me a kicking for why have you turned that stage off at 10:30 when your festival's on till 11? Why is the sound quiet on that stage? It's because I have to create an organic egress. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise, transports will fall down, networks will fall down. 80,000 people can't leave sites at once. It's dangerous. So when they put the 10 p.m. curfew in, pushing hundreds of thousands of people out at exactly the same time, I knew that was dangerous and that was spreading the virus. So that was wrong. And the other thing was the Scotch egg rule. So you could have a pint if you ate a Scotch egg or a substantial meal, a sandwich or something like that, which seemed ludicrous to me because it was table service only. Mm-hmm. So at the time, my QC at the time, Casey, David Locke, who's a genius, looked, and in Greater Manchester, there were 1,806 wet-led pubs. They're pubs that don't serve food. And when you dig into them, most of those pubs are in our most deprived areas. So why is it right for myself and Demi, my wife, to be able to go into Alty, see you at another table, have a bit of social... Why is that funny? See social activity... I can have a couple of pints, yeah, a sandwich, but those in our most deprived areas can't. So we won it on a class basis. And every night, like clockwork, I let our miniature sausage dog out, Pickle, for his wee. I go for a wee at the same time in the downstairs loo. And it's framed, Sasha Lord versus Matt Hancock in the High Court, and it's stamped that I won it. And it's the best wee of the day, honestly. I just see his little smug face.
And then the other thing that you brought in, because I think we were talking before about after the arena attack, the one thing that we did as Mancunians was we all felt that urge to come back into the city centre straight away, not be cowed, not be put off by what had happened. And we all stood in St Anne's Square, which was a very kind of moving moment. But in COVID, when we had the crisis, although we wanted to come together, we just couldn't do that at all. So you came up with another amazing idea at the time.
Well, no, that was on the back of two raves that happened. There was an illegal rave for 6,000, another illegal rave for 2,000. And very sadly, with illegal raves, when there's no security, no paramedics, no police there or anything, there will always be incidents. Some poor kid died. There's a couple of knife attacks. There was Andy Burnham that said, look, what can we do to entertain people? This was the moment when I was wearing marigolds to go to Sainsbury's. You know, we all were panicking, weren't we? We didn't know what was, you know, is this the end of the world? We now know differently, obviously. But I was like, Andy, I can't put a stage up in a park or anything like that. So for 3 days, I was scouring the internet and I came across this thing in Berlin called United We Stream, where they put a DJ into a closed nightclub and then streamed it every Friday and Saturday. So I phoned Andy up and was like, I've seen something. We can do this on steroids. And he gave me the keys to the Met Theatre in Bury. Everything was socially distanced. I picked up my black book, spoke to loads of artists. And for 10 weeks, I said to people, look, this is free to watch every Friday, every Saturday. Just entertain yourselves. If you can donate £1, £2, please do it. And we had 20.4 million viewers. We raised £612,000 that went to loads of freelancers and artists across the city. And it's probably one of my proudest achievements I've ever done. Every single, you name it, Getter, Cox, Calvin, Fat Boy, New Order, they all played for not one penny. And it was fantastic. The one thing I do remember is all the artists had letters from Andy, because you could drive around if you were, I forget the wording now, if you were serving a purpose, like nurses or police could drive around.
That's all, yeah.
So all the artists had these letters. I was absolutely desperate to be pulled over. Like, desperate to get pulled over, but sadly, I just wanted to go, oh, sod off, look at this here.
And it was like over £600,000 was raised, wasn't it?
£612,000.
Yeah, that's incredible, yeah. Does anybody remember those evenings? The Aperol Spritz. Oh, I fell asleep. I slumped over the laptop one night. It was when we had to go and do the NHS clap as well. And I, one day, on the Friday, I said I didn't do the clap last night. And my daughter went, Mum, you're out there for 2 hours. I couldn't remember it. We were all so drunk in the drive. And we were saying that our neighbours, when the bins came round on the Thursday, it sounded like Wetherspoons after a bank holiday Monday. I've never heard anything like it.
Oh, I was
shocking.
Bad the first few weeks. Because the weather was so good, and I'm so fortunate enough to have a garden, that me and Emmy, I think we were sponsoring Whispering Angel the first few weeks. And there was this day where I'd done a pre-record for Northwest Tonight, and I sat down at 6 o'clock to watch it, and we were both watching it, and I said to Demi, I said, that's a really bad angle, isn't it? She's like, what do you mean? I said, look at my face there, I look like a puffer fish. And she went, that's how you look. And from that day, that's when I started. So I do 1 hour, 10 minutes power walk every morning. So I phone you quite a bit. Yeah. I'm not going to phone you again then now. But it was because of that there. We piled the weight on during those first few weeks. God. Piled it. Cheese boards, everything. It was all coming out.
It's like I got PTSD over that time now. I can't really remember much about it. So what's next? You got some announcements. You're stepping down, or are you going to be spending less time in the warehouse project?
Not stepping down, there for the day-to-day business, but I'm 52 now. I can't be working Friday and Saturday till 3, 4, 5 in the morning. Something which I'm not announced yet, I'm going to announce, you know about this already, to do with the book. So any revenue from the book that comes to me is going to go directly to my charity. So we set up the Sacha Lord Foundation, myself and Demi, which we're going to launch properly in a couple of months. You're helping the launch, aren't you? And it's to help kids who were like me at my age, at like 16, 17, 18, had real anxiety, didn't know what they were going to do for the rest of their lives. So if I can help kids in Greater Manchester between 18 and 25 and get them into events and hospitality, then that's what the charity's going to do.
Yeah, I think it's amazing. Great, great piece of work. And then also we've got Within Shore Park, so you've got the bank holiday weekend.
Within Shore Park, yeah. So this year we've got New Order, we've got Blossoms. There's one more that we're hoping comes off. I'm not going to tell you.
Go on. No,
I can't tell you.
So did anybody go last year?
It was good, wasn't it?
It was brilliant.
He was good.
He insulted Andy Burnham slightly. Did he?
Well, he did. He said the C word. I'm not going to say the C word. That's the one word I find really offensive. So he said, I'm going to dedicate this song to Andy Burnham. And then he played The Importance of Being Idle. And I was stood next to Andy thinking, shit. But then he apologised and said he got his track listings messed up and he didn't want to make Andy sound like a bit of a C. And then he played the master plan, which kind of brought it back again. But he's a nice guy, you know.
Nice, yeah.
Liam's my favourite out of the two of them. Liam has this swagger on TV, but he's actually such a lovely person. Mm. Very, very down to earth. Very funny. He does a lot of charity stuff. Mm. I'm Team Liam.
I can't wait to see him at Cult Live.
He's going to be angry with that as well.
I know you are, Of course you are.
Yes.
The queue. I'm going to ask you a quick fire Manchester round, and then we can take some questions. So, okay. First record that you bought?
Video Kill the Radio Star by Buggles.
Wow.
What?
Not what I was expecting.
Yeah.
I must have missed that in the book. Now, I know the answer to this. Do you like dancing?
Eaters. Burnham's doing Strictly Come Dancing next Saturday.
Stop it.
No, not the TV one. He's doing it for I'd put a quick resignation in if he was. No, he's doing it for charity this Saturday.
Where at?
I'm not sure it is. If you look, I've retweeted it. It's for Rob Burrows, actually. It's a good cause.
What? On earth? Pay good money. Have you ever been seen dancing?
I doubt it.
Not even a kitchen disco?
Oh, yeah. Demi sees me dancing the whole time. I can actually do a really good moonwalk.
Can you?
Yeah, really good.
Do you want to do it now?
No.
No. I'm trying to figure out what kind of style dancer you'd be. I can't even imagine.
It's probably a bit Manchester. Yeah.
What's your biggest achievement?
Well, this isn't a bad one. I'm quite pleased with that. I think my proudest moment was being announced as Nighttime Economy Advisor, June the 6th, 2018.
Yeah. And are you going to go to Westminster?
No. Everyone keeps asking me this question. No, it's not for me.
All right. Describe Manchester in three words.
The fucking best.
Yeah. Love that.
Well, we are though, aren't we?
Yeah. And which track would you say sums up Manchester most for you?
So for me, it was always Voodoo Ray, but that stopped in 2017. It has to be Don't Look Back in Anger for me. I think that is our unofficial anthem, and it's come out of the arena. I can't think of any other track that means more Manchester than that to me.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much.
No, thank you.
Are you having a holiday soon?
9 weeks.
Right.
But can I just say thank you so much for your support behind the book. It means the world. It really does. And as I said at the beginning, you know, I left school with a U in English Lit. So to get that, I can't wait to announce it tomorrow. And let's watch the trolls come out, the haters. And I'll be driving to work like that.
You get your mum on them.
Oh, don't.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Sasha.
Thank you.
Great to hear those tales from Manchester's dance floors with Sasha Lord and Lisa Morton. How amazing was that? Thanks for listening to this episode of Inside Stories from the MPA, Manchester's Publicity Association. We'll hear from us again in about a month's time. This podcast was produced by Purposeful Podcasts. You want to build a community around your business or your brand, please do get in touch with the team at purposefulpodcast.com. Do remember to rate and review this podcast, because that means more people get to find out about us. And if you know people who aren't in the MPA but might be interested in joining, then please do share Inside Stories with them too.